Chapter 7 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 7. As I have now got on to the subject of the ransom libel suit, which was tried in the King's Bench Division in 1913, I will here reproduce a portion of the letter I wrote to Frank Harris in Nice at his request in 1925, and which is incorporated in the new preface to Harris's Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde. The new preface was published by the Fortune Press in London in the same year, and a second edition of it has recently appeared. I quote here all that part of my letter which relates to Robert Ross and the ransom case. I shall then go back to the period I had reached in these memoirs when I was at Oxford and first met Oscar Wilde. Now to come to the question of Robert Ross. When I start to write about him, I am reminded of that phrase of St. Paul, the mystery of iniquity. Why he behaved in the dreadful way he did, and what made him hate me, and use diabolical skill and cunning in his efforts to destroy my character, I have not the slightest idea. The trouble about Ross has always been that what he did was so bad as to be, on the face of it, incredible. Most people simply will not believe that any man could be such a villain and such a hypocrite. All I can do is to give as briefly as possible the main facts as they exist and can be proved, not by my own statements, but by the irrefutable evidence of publicly recorded events. When Oscar Wilde died in Paris, I was in Scotland, and I did not reach Paris till 2 days after his death, just in time to attend the funeral, the cost of which I paid. Ross, with whom I was then, as I supposed, on terms of great friendship, was there when Wilde died, and it was he who telegraphed me informing me of Wilde's death. While Wilde lay dead, and before I arrived in Paris, Ross went through the papers and manuscripts he found in Wilde's rooms. Among them he found a quantity of my letters to Wilde. These letters he appropriated without a word to me. I naturally had not the slightest idea that he had found and stolen letters written by me to Wilde, and I suppose that even those queerly misguided persons who profess to admire Ross as a model of faithful friendship, and who gave him a public testimonial after I had exposed him in 1914 at the Old Bailey, will admit that to steal or appropriate letters written by one of one's friends to another friend, and to keep them secretly, and finally use them against their writer in a law court, is a wicked, disgraceful, and dishonourable action. The facts as to this business cannot be denied. Ross took my letters, and his executors or heirs have got them to this day. How many letters he found and kept, I have no idea. When the ransom case, in which I sued Ransom for a libel which he had been inspired by Ross to write against me in his Oscar Wilde A Critical Study, came on, some of these letters were produced by Ross and put to me in court during my cross-examination by Sir James Campbell, Ransom's counsel. The letters were letters of which, as I said then, and have frequently said since in the witness box, I am ashamed. Their production when I was quite unaware of their existence, and their being sprung upon me in the witness box 15 years after they were written, caused me to lose my case against Ransom. Mr. Commins Carr, K.C., who was subsequently my counsel in 4 other lawsuits, in all of which I was successful, told me some years later that he could not understand how I lost the Ransom case. He said to me, "If your case had been put to the jury, you could not have lost it." My case was not put to the jury, partly because my counsel and old friend, Mr. Cecil Hayes, was, as he would be the first to admit, outmatched and overwhelmed by the array of counsel against him. Sir James Campbell, Mr. F. E. Smith, now Lord Birkenhead, and Mr. McCardy, now Mr. Justice McCardy. Mr. Hayes was at that time an inexperienced junior, and had not the skill and power as an advocate which he has since acquired. The judge who tried the case, Mr. Justice Darling, was bitterly hostile to me throughout, and I was, unfortunately for me, bound by a promise that I'd given to Cecil Hayes, on my word of honour, that I would not attack the judge, however great provocation he gave me. So I was simply a dumb lamb for the slaughter. Although I produced my passbooks and proved that I'd given Wilde £390 in cheques, in addition to a lot of ready money, in the 1 year between the death of my father and the death of Wilde, and although I proved that when I left Wilde at my villa in Naples, I gave him £200, paid to him by my mother through Mr. Moradi, whom I called as a witness, and that at the very moment when he was writing his disgraceful letter to Ross, printed, at Ross's instigation, in your book on page 406, in which he says that I left him penniless at Naples, he had £200 of my money in his pocket, a fact perfectly well known to Ross, who was sharing rooms with Moradi at the time the payment of the £200 was made. In spite of all this, I say, I lost my case on the prejudice caused against me by the production of these letters stolen by Ross and secretly kept for all those years. At the same ransom trial, the unpublished part of De Profundis was brought out against me. For the history of this manuscript, I can best refer you to Ross's own preface to the first edition of De Profundis, published in 1905, which I reviewed for you in that year in your paper, The Candid Friend, without having the slightest idea that it was a letter addressed by Wilde to me. Ross, in his preface, says that the manuscript was given to him by Wilde on the day he left prison. Neither he nor Wilde ever said a word about it to me. I had no knowledge of its existence till the year 1912, when a copy of the whole manuscript, including the hitherto unpublished part, was sent to me as part of Ransom's Particulars of Justification by the solicitors Lewis and Lewis. I have little to say about this dreadful piece of cold-blooded, malignant malice, hypocrisy, and lying. It passes my comprehension that any reasonable being can be taken in by such stuff. As I have already convinced you that almost every word it contains is a lie, or distortion of the truth, and as, moreover, you always thought very meanly of it, and would never, as you now tell me, have swallowed any of it, if Ross had not bolstered it up by his own lies and misrepresentation, I need not now waste much more ink over it. The letters of Wilde to me, written at Berneval after he left prison, which have been published in America in a privately printed edition issued by Mr. William Andrews Clarke, are, in themselves, quite sufficient to demonstrate the falsity and wickedness of his attack on me in De Profundis. I have, moreover, answered his mostly absurd allegations fully in my book, Oscar Wilde and Myself. Just take this as an example of Wilde's reckless perversion of truth. He says in De Profundis, page 555 of your book, Appendix, I am not speaking in phrases of rhetorical exaggeration, but in terms of absolute truth, when I remind you that during the whole time we were together, I never wrote one single line, whether at Torquay, Goring, London, Florence, or elsewhere, my life, as long as you were by my side, was entirely sterile and uncreative, and with few intervals you were, I regret to say, by my side always. Well, as stated in my book, Oscar Wilde and Myself, page 137, the fact is that Wilde planned and wrote the whole of A Woman of No Importance while we were together at Lady Mount Temple's house at Babbacombe, Torquay. Lady Mount Temple lent him the house, and I stayed there with him, accompanied by a tutor, Mr. Dodgson Campbell, now of the British Museum, for about 2 months. That he wrote the whole of The Importance of Being Earnest while I was with him at Worthing, and An Ideal Husband, partly at Goring and partly in London, in rooms he took at St. James's Place, where I saw him every day. He also did the final version of the Ballad of Reading Gaol in my villa at Naples. Even De Profundis is a letter written to me. In his letter to me from Berneval, beginning, "My own darling boy," written just before he joined me in Naples, he says, "I feel that my only hope of doing beautiful work in art is being with you. It was not so in old days, but now it is different. I feel that only with you can I do anything at all." It is the same right through the De Profundis letter. Lie, lie, lie. Oscar Wilde told you himself that in prison he suffered from wild delusions. He appears to have committed the record of these delusions to paper. Most of his letter is simply incomprehensible to me. He invents the maddest fictions. An 11-page telegram, supposed to have been sent by me to him. Purely imaginary scenes at Voisin's and Pilard's. The grotesque nonsense of his account of a quarrel we had at Brighton, which both of us had, as I supposed, forgotten all about a week after it happened. My alleged threats of suicide and wild despair while I was separated from him and staying in Egypt, where, as a matter of fact, I stayed for 3 months as the guest of Lord and Lady Cromer at the British Agency and had a most lively and cheerful time, as Reggie Turner and E.F. Benson, who met me out there and went up the Nile with me, could testify. His monstrous lies about the money he alleged I got from him, lies which he could not support by one single cheque or entry in his passbook. The whole letter is the raving of a lunatic, a man driven mad by impotent rage and malice and malevolent desire to injure at all costs the friend he professed to love and with whom he at once resumed friendly relations when he got out of prison. I pass to what happened after the ransom trial had gone against me. My wife left me, my only child was taken away from me, my home was broken up, and I was left penniless and ruined, socially as well as financially. I recognised that the author of all this havoc was Robert Ross. I knew of my own knowledge, as did literally thousands of others in London, that Ross was exactly the same sort of man in his private life as Wilde had been. The difference between Ross and me was that while I, as a boy of 20, had come under Wilde's influence and had got myself mixed up in the awful gang that surrounded him, I had long since, more than 12 years then, escaped out of it all. I had married within a little more than a year of Wilde's death, and I was living a happy, healthy, and normal life with my wife and child. Ross, on the other hand, had become more and more obsessed with the dreadful vice which had been the bane of Oscar Wilde. The mantle of Wilde in this respect had fallen on him. He was the high priest of all the sodomites in London, and it was he who was held up to the world as the faithful friend of Wilde, out of the exploitation of whose cult he had made a fortune. The noble, disinterested friend, the pure, the holy person, in contrast to the wicked and depraved Alfred Douglas, who had ruined Oscar Wilde and deserted him. Flesh and blood couldn't stand it, and I swore the day after the ransom trial that I would never rest till I had publicly exposed Ross in his true colours. I don't want to prolong this letter unduly, and I must endeavour to stick to essentials and to be as brief as possible. It took me 2 years to bring Ross to book. How I did it without money and with scarcely a friend in the world, apart from my mother, is something of a miracle. I adopted the same method as that employed by my father. That is to say, I libelled Ross and at last forced him to take criminal proceedings against me. It took a great deal more libelling to bring Ross to the fighting point than it did to bring Wilde. I began by libelling him to Mr. Justice Darling, the judge who had tried the ransom case. Mr. Justice Darling made a public reference to my letter from the bench, read it aloud in court, and handed it to counsel representing Ross. No doubt he thought that immediate criminal proceedings against me would follow, but Ross took what I had said lying down. It was not till I had several times repeated the libel in writing to his friends, Mr. and Mrs. Asquith, and till I had printed and broadcasted two pamphlets containing the same libel, that I goaded him into action. My father had accused Wilde of posing as a sodomite. I applied the following flowers of speech to Ross: an unspeakable skunk, a filthy B-blank, a notorious sodomite, an habitual debaucher and corrupter of young boys right down to the present day, and, last but not least, a blackmailer. I was arrested and kept 5 days without bail at Brixton Prison. I pleaded justification, and when I finally got out of Brixton on bail, I had about 5 weeks in which to find enough evidence to justify my libels, with the alternative of getting anything between 6 months and 2 years imprisonment. I had not a scrap of evidence beyond my own private knowledge, which was based on the fact that Ross never made the slightest attempt to conceal his proclivities. He boasted openly of what he did, and had done, all his life. This, however, was no good, or very little good, for my plea of justification. I cannot tell you now, it would take too long, all about how I got the evidence. I firmly believe that my getting it was a supernatural business, and was due to the fact that, having by this time become a devout Catholic, I cast myself wholly on Providence, and prayed for help in my desperate need. Just about a week before my trial, and when I had almost given up hope, I stumbled right into the evidence. In 2 days thereafter, with the assistance of my solicitor, Mr. Edward Bell, I had an array of 13 or 14 witnesses, and the plea was drawn up by my counsel, Mr. Cummins Carr. The trial lasted 8 days at the Old Bailey. It went my way from the first. After Sir Ernest Wilde, K.C., now Recorder of London, had opened for Ross in a speech in which he painted me as blackly as possible to the jury, he put his client into the box. Ross's cross-examination by Cummins Carr was quite as sensational as that of Wilde by Carson. By the time it was half over, I had the case won. The foreman of the jury told me, after the case was over, that he and most of the jury wanted to stop the case and give me a verdict immediately after Ross's cross-examination, but that one man, the same who ultimately caused the disagreement of the jury, refused to listen to such a proposition. So the case went on. I went into the box myself and was cross-examined for many hours by Wilde, and my stolen letters were again put to me. But, this time round, they produced little effect. They have been produced twice since, once at the Pemberton Billing trial, when I scored heavily and helped to win the verdict, and finally at the hearing of my action against the Evening News in 1921, for libelling me by saying that I had shown marked signs of degeneracy, when I was cross-examined by Sir Douglas Hogg, the Attorney General, for 6 hours, and got a verdict and £1,000 damages, and a rider from the jury expressing an opinion that the constant bringing up of these letters was disgraceful, and that they ought to be returned to me or destroyed. Witness after witness gave the most damning evidence against Ross, and the judge, Mr. Justice Coleridge, summed up against him in a very deadly, though perfectly fair, way. In fact, the charges I brought against Ross, which were specific charges giving names of victims, dates, and full particulars, were proved up to the hilt. The evidence of Inspector West, with 25 years' service at Scotland Yard and Vine Street, would alone have been enough to justify my charges. The inspector, who came of his own accord and volunteered evidence, swore that in his professional capacity as a detective, who had for 15 years patrolled the neighbourhood of Vine Street, Piccadilly, etc., at night, he had known Ross during all those years as an habitual associate of sodomites and male prostitutes. However, the jury, after being out about 3 hours, came back and said they could not agree on a verdict, and I was released again on bail and bound over to come up for trial at the next sessions. When I left the court, I found 9 members of the jury, including the foreman, waiting for me outside. They expressed their deep regret at the result and told me that it was due to one man who absolutely refused to give a verdict against Ross. They all shook hands with me and congratulated me. They told me they were all against me at first and amazed to find how right I was and what a different person I was from what they had always imagined. Meanwhile, the papers in London had almost entirely suppressed all mention of this sensational case. Instead of the columns and columns which they had given to the Ransom case when I lost, now there was day by day a meagre half-column or a mere paragraph. The public was left quite in the dark as to what had happened, and Mr. Blumenfeld, the editor of the Daily Express, when I complained to him of the shameful way I had been treated in the reports in his paper, naively told me that the bad reports were not due to any prejudice or unfair feeling against me, because, said he, to tell the truth, I haven't the least idea how or why you were acquitted or what happened. Yet the verbatim report of this, probably the most sensational case that has ever been tried at the Old Bailey, was available to all the newspapers. The treatment I received at this time destroyed the last vestige of a belief in British fair play which had survived my former experience. However, even the press couldn't save Ross. His counsel first proposed to enter a nolle prosequi with my consent, each side paying its own costs. I declined to agree to this, and expressed my firm determination to come up at the next sessions and be tried again, and I added a little more evidence to my plea of justification. That settled Ross. He climbed down completely. His counsel, Wilde, now came forward with the proposal that if I would agree to allow a nolle prosequi to be entered, that is, allow the prosecution to be withdrawn, Lewis and Lewis, on behalf of Ross, would pay my costs and out-of-pocket expenses, about £600. This was a godsend to me, as I was practically without a penny, and I accepted the offer with joy, my plea of justification remaining on record as established at the Central Criminal Court, where anyone is at liberty to go and inspect it. On the other hand, the disagreement probably saved Ross from a criminal prosecution, which would almost certainly have followed unavoidably if the jury had brought in a verdict against him. It was, by the way, Mr. Forrest Fulton, junior counsel for Ross, and the son of the late Recorder of London, who pointed out to Mr. Bell, my solicitor, that the entering of a nolle prosequi on Ross's behalf was an even greater victory for me than a verdict would have been, for the obvious reason that a nolle prosequi entered under such circumstances is an acknowledgement of guilt and is equal to a plea of guilty on the part of the prosecutor. I have only to add, to be finished once for all with the odious subject of Ross, that about 3 months after the result of my trial at the Old Bailey had been reported in the papers, a public testimonial and a gift of £700 were presented to Robert Ross. The testimonial, which expressed the greatest love, friendship, and admiration for Ross as a faithful friend and distinguished man of letters, was got up by Mr., now Sir, Edmund Goss, who, together with Mr. H.G. Wells, gave evidence as to character for Ross at my trial. They both declared, to the bewilderment of the judge and jury, that they had known and loved Ross for years, and that he was the most pure-minded man they had ever known. The testimonial was signed by about 350 people, including the Prime Minister and Mrs. Asquith, a dozen peers, an Anglican bishop, and a number of more or less distinguished persons in the social, literary, and artistic world. After the trial, Ross had to resign the lucrative post of Assessor of Picture Valuations to the Board of Trade at £1,500 a year, which had been bestowed on him by Mr. Asquith. but he was neither ostracized nor seriously affected in his social position. The Asquiths continued to receive him. Another government appointment was given to him a year later, and when he died, the Times devoted a whole column to his praise as a type of all that is noblest and best in an English gentleman. Comment is needless. I have never been able to understand the attitude of the curious people who make a hero of Ross, any more than I could ever understand Ross's own villainies and unspeakable meannesses. It is well to remember that when I justified against Ross, I had to prove that, in addition to being a votary of Wilde's vices, he was also a blackmailer. I proved the one thing just as much as I proved the other. If the Asquiths and Messrs. Goss, Wells, and the rest like that sort of thing, it is, of course, no affair of mine, but surely there is something very queer about the whole business. I have long given up bothering about it myself, and I must leave the further discussion and examination of it to you and to your readers, if you decide to incorporate this letter in your revised Life of Oscar Wilde. End of chapter 7.